Please welcome Dr. Glenn Sunshine.
I have a habit of picking ridiculously large topics to talk about. And in this particular case, I didn't do that. I picked four ridiculously large topics. But we're going to start off looking at the development of the Western political tradition. First of all, focusing on politics. Next one, we'll do economics. Tomorrow, we'll start with human rights, where that comes from. And after that, there will be something on philanthropy, charity, and things like that, and what Christianity has to do with our modern ideas in that area. Now, as we're talking about politics today, this is obviously an absolutely huge subject. But what we're going to do is we're going to look at three main issues here that are really critically important in the entire development of Western political thought, and especially in the founding of the United States. These are, first of all, the separation of church and state. This is actually a Christian invention. Most people don't understand that. But we also have to define what we mean by those terms. The second is the influence of St. Augustine of Hippo, a very, very important theologian from the late 4th and early 5th century. The third is the influence of Aristotle and his politics. The interaction of these three really end up shaping a whole lot of what happens in Western political development. So that's what we're going to do. That's the overview. Let me see if I can get the clicker to work. Great. Okay, so first of all, the distinction between church and state. Most people don't realize this, but it turns out that every major world religion except one came to power, rose, and became a major religion with the support of the state. The only one that didn't was Christianity. For the first 300 years, Christians were a persecuted and unpopular minority religion in the Roman Empire. Okay. The persecution wasn't constant, it was sporadic, but it's pretty clear that they were very, very unpopular with the general population and with the ruling powers. They were seen as a religion of women and slaves. Now, that isn't entirely fair. When you take a look, even very early on, there are upper-class people who are converting, there are men converting, and so on. But the very fact that Christians welcomed women and slaves into their congregations, and even more than that, allowed them to have positions of authority within those congregations, including women, by the way, in the early church. Slaves rose to be bishops by the end of the first or beginning of the second century, things like that. It meant that the Roman Empire viewed this as a religion for them, for these, well, obviously inferior types. Now, we'll talk more about the implications of that when we get to the issue of human rights. But over time, Christianity did, in fact, grow in the empire. We're not sure exactly what the numbers are, but by the beginning of the 4th century, they are still an unpopular minority, but they're very well-organized, urban-based, things like that. And then in the early 4th century, something changes. The Emperor Constantine comes to the throne. He's a pagan initially, at least, although he has relatives who are Christians. And there's a civil war that's fought, he consolidates control of the empire. And right after he does that, he issues something called the Edict of Milan. And the Edict of Milan decriminalizes Christianity. And then Constantine announces that he has converted to Christianity as well. Now, a few words about this. There's a lot of misunderstandings here as well. First of all, Constantine does not make Christianity the official religion of the empire. All he does is make it a legal religion within the empire. It's a later emperor named Theodosius who makes Rome officially a Christian empire. Now, secondly, there's a lot of doubt about whether Constantine's conversion was genuine. And there are a number of different arguments for this, one of them, for example, being that he didn't get baptized until he was on his deathbed. So this shows, of course, according to the people who argue this, that he was actually a pagan, and this deathbed baptism was something that was more or less forced on him. And that what he really was doing was making Christianity legal as a way to get the support of Christians for taking the imperial throne. Now, there are a number of things that are wrong with this theory, even though it is actually the most popular one out there. The first of them is that Constantine was already emperor before he legalized Christianity. So it's hard to see how currying the support of the Christians after he comes to the throne really helps him. Secondly, Christians were still a minority. They were well-organized minority, urban-based and all that, but they were still a minority group, maybe 10% of the empire. And they were still exceedingly unpopular. So Constantine was a good politician. I think he would have calculated that he had more to lose than to gain by supporting the Christians. It just doesn't really make sense otherwise. So I personally think his conversion was genuine, if at times a bit misunderstood. He himself didn't really get a lot of things about Christianity, I think. The deathbed baptism, by the way, was common practice among Christians in the period. They believed that when you were baptized, it washed away all your sins. So the ideal is to get baptized just before you die so you don't have a chance to mess it up. They weren't really sure what happened, you see, if you sinned after baptism. They didn't quite have their theology down on that point. Okay, so Constantine converts. He makes Christianity legal. Eventually, it also becomes, like Senator Theodosius a little later, it will also become the official religion of the empire. Now, what this means is that Christianity is in a unique position relative to other major world religions. You have 300 years in which Christianity exists. The church exists as a separate institution from the state. What that means is Christians have always understood church and state to be separate institutions of necessity. Like I said, the first three centuries of the Christian era, persecuted minority religion. You can't argue that church and state are the same thing or that the church is a branch of the state or anything else. Okay. That is a critically important point. Oh, and by the way, it's got some other implications too, which we'll go into later, but not the least of which is that Christianity is also, even though it is not part of the state, it is an inescapably political religion. Why is that? Well, the most fundamental Christian confession, right from day one, is Jesus is Lord. In the context of the Roman Empire, making that statement meant two things. First of all, Jesus is divine. And secondly, if Jesus is Lord, Caesar isn't. And that is why the Romans persecuted the Christians, because they refused to acknowledge Caesar as the final authority in all areas of life. So what this means, then, is that the church and the state are separate institutions. And from that point on, one of the driving forces in Western political history is trying to understand what the relationship of church and state ought to be. There is always a tension between them. There's a recognition that there's a division of labor involved. The church has responsibilities in certain areas that the state doesn't. The state has responsibilities in certain areas that the church doesn't. This goes back to Jesus' words when he was asked if it's legal to pay taxes to Caesar. Jesus says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. There are things that are legitimately Caesar's, but render to God the things that are God. There are things that properly do not belong to Caesar. So how do you understand this? How do you get the balance between church and state? Western history is driven, for most of history, by that question. Sometimes the state has the upper hand, and the church is subordinate to the state. Sometimes the church has the upper hand and tries to make the state subordinate to it. It varies. But that tension is always in place, and precisely where the division of labor is between the two is also always in place. This is a driving force even in the founding of America, as we'll see at the end of this talk. Now, along with that, it also creates space in society that didn't exist before. Up to this point, Caesar was Lord in the Roman Empire. And what that meant was that Caesar was ultimately in charge of everything that happened. Everything, Caesar was the head of the state. Rome was ruled by law. Virtually every area of life, except family life, was governed by Roman law, and even family life was to some extent. And as head of the state, Caesar was head of all of that. There wasn't a single area of life that was not under the authority of the government. When you say Jesus is Lord, when you say, and Caesar isn't, when you say that the church and the state are separate institutions, what you are saying is there is an area in life where Caesar does not have authority. And once you allow the possibility that there is one area of life where Caesar doesn't have authority, it opens the door for other areas as well. And the net result is that what is going to, because Jesus is the only one who's Lord of everything. Okay. So what that does is it creates space within society for other kinds of institutions to develop that are not directly under state control, that are so-called intermediate institutions that mediate, that come between the state and the individual, that buffer the individual, that protect the individual from the overreach of the state. So you will get institutions developing in the Middle Ages, like guilds, which regulate economic life. You will get groups that are involved in philanthropy. You will get schools. You will get a whole range of things that begin to carve out spheres that are relatively autonomous, relatively free from state control. And this is going to create this possibility of what we call civil society. When people talk about civil society, what they really mean, the people who use it in its technical sense, what they really mean is the notion of a society that has these kinds of intermediate institutions that create a buffer between the individual and the state so that the state doesn't have so much control and so much authority over the individual life. And it's saying, in effect, that in a Christian context, Jesus is the only one that has authority over all areas of life. In the political world, there are things that are under the control of the government, and properly so, but there are a lot of things that are not, frankly, the government's business. And that concept of civil society is a consequence of this distinction between church and state. Without that, you never get there. In every other society, there is no buffer, historically. There is no buffer between the individual and the state. That's unique to the Western tradition, and it comes about because of this issue. Our second topic within this area of political development is the influence of St. Augustine of Hippo, and in particular his book, The City of God. Now, this book was written in the early 500s, right after the Visigoths sacked the city of Rome, 410 AD. When the Visigoths sacked Rome, remember, Rome is not, it is now officially a Christian state, but it still allows pagan religions to operate within the empire. And the pagans at this point came out and said, you know, when Rome was pagan, it never fell to the barbarians. The city was inviolate, except in its very early history. It was never sacked. Now that it's become Christian, the gods have obviously withdrawn their protection from the city, and that's why we fell. We fell because we became Christians. And what we really need to do, therefore, is return to paganism. Augustine wrote the book, The City of God, to counteract that. And in essence, what he said is, Rome fell not because it was too Christian, but because it wasn't Christian enough. Now, in the book, he posits that the world has two cities, represented by Babylon and Jerusalem. The first of them, Babylon, is the city of man. The city of man is, we would describe it as the fallen world. Okay, what it really is, he says, the city of man is a city that is ruled by people who are power hungry, who are into self-aggrandizement, their own personal glory. It operates on the basis of threats and violence, and its goal is to impose its will and its authority on everybody else. Okay, this isn't, strictly speaking, a political entity in Augustine's mind. Frankly, it refers to the entire fallen world. No matter where you are in the fallen world, whether it's at the level of government, whether it's in a family, whether it's in any community, anywhere, this is the way the city of man works. It's about personal power. It's about aggrandizement. It's about lording it over other people, and it's doing it through threats of violence. Very negative picture, frankly, of the fallen world, but I think a quite an accurate one. The alternative, though, is the city of God. The city of God operates on totally different premises from the city of man. The city of God is built around love of God first and love of neighbor as a consequence. It operates not on the basis of power and authority. It operates on the basis of love and self-sacrifice. Its weapons are prayer, penance, repentance, love, those sorts of things. And it's not about personal aggrandizement at all. It's about loving God, serving God, and glorifying him. He says these two cities exist within the world, and everybody's a citizen of one or the other. And world history, and the city of God includes an entire world history based on the Bible, world history is really the story of the battle between these two cities. Now, Augustine never identifies the state with Babylon and the church with Jerusalem. He never says the state is the city of man and the church is the city of God. He doesn't go there. A later pope, however, will, a guy by the name of Gelasius, he's going to write a treatise in which he's going to say, okay, the church is the city of God and the state is the city of man. The state has power, the church has authority, and he's going to draw this distinction. It's not one that Augustine made. And Augustine, I think, would particularly have objected to the idea of identifying an institutional church with the city of God. But be that as it may, Gelasius got part of it right, the idea that the state is a part, at least, of the city of man is really central to Augustine's thought. In other words, what this means is that the state is fallen. The state fundamentally is run by human beings who are in a state of original sin. Original sin, the doctrine of original sin, states that human beings have an inborn tendency to sin, to do the wrong thing. And because people do have this fallen nature, because they are affected by sin to that extent, what that means is that these people running the state is also going to be that way. The state is also going to be in a state of sin. It means it is going to be corrupt. It means that it is going to be self-aggrandizing. And frankly, in a fallen world, unfortunately, the state is also necessary. Because, you see, in the absence of the state, in the absence of some sort of external constraints on people's behavior, the city of man will operate within the human heart, and we will abuse each other. And the state exists to prevent that from happening. Now, it does it itself by being essentially organized abuse. To Augustine, the state is at best a necessary evil because the state is effectively organized oppression. But nonetheless, it is important because what it does is it, through terror, frankly, it keeps people from doing violence to each other. Why does the state do that? The state does that because it wants to maintain its own power. The state wants to maintain its own power, and therefore it has to control other people, because if they are allowed to act out their worst impulses, if they're allowed to abuse their neighbor, if they're allowed to steal and kill and so on, then the state will lose power. It'll create anarchy, it'll create chaos, and the state will lose its power. So the state is actually interested in maintaining a kind of peace in the world. But that peace serves its own ends of self-aggrandizement and power. The church is also interested in peace in the world, but for totally different reasons. The church wants to promote peace because Jesus is the Prince of Peace. Because out of love of our neighbor, we want to have peace. Because that is good for our neighbor. It is good for our communities. So the church and state, the city of God and the city of man, let's be careful here. The city of God and city of man can cooperate. They can work together. They work for common ends in many cases, but their methods and their goals are totally different. The state works by coercion, by threats of violence. The church works by love, forgiveness, penance, all of those sorts of things. But they can, in fact, work together to produce peace. So you have a tension, again, a tension between the two, working for common goals but for totally different reasons. The key point of all of this, though, is that at its root, what Augustine tells us is that government is inevitably, in his mind, corrupt. And therefore, it cannot be trusted with power. Fundamentally, you can't get rid of government, and government will always have power. But fundamentally, you cannot trust them, because the government will abuse the power. You have to watch over them carefully to try to find ways to soften its strength, to try to prevent it from going toward abuse. The entire distrust that we have of government in the Western political tradition, all of it, ultimately dates back to Augustine. So this negative view of government is actually an important component of Western politics, but it is not the only one. There's another source that becomes really important, and this is particularly in the Middle Ages, and it's a guy named Aristotle. Aristotle was an ancient Greek philosopher, a pretty bright guy, wrote about just about every subject under the sun. And in the 12th century, now, some of Aristotle's works were known in Western Europe from the, well, really from the earliest days. They were never lost. But there were a lot of them that had been lost, that there were no surviving copies in Western Europe. Well, in the 12th century, Christian scholars in Spain found copies of a bunch of Aristotle's works that the Muslim scholars there had. And they gleefully began translating these new works by Aristotle, new to them, new works by Aristotle into Latin so that scholars could study them in Western Europe. This became known as the New Aristotle, and Aristotle's Politics was one of these books. Now, I should note as an aside here that the reason why the Muslim world had Aristotle and the Latin world didn't is because the Muslim world had conquered Syria and Egypt. And it turns out that Islamic medicine in the period was based on Greek medicine, Galen, and it was based on, Muslim philosophy was based on Aristotle and all that. And they got that because they conquered these areas that had these books. The books were translated from the original Greek into Arabic by Christian scholars, notably a guy named Hunayn ibn Ishaq, who lived around roughly the year 900. He's the one who translated, he's a Christian, he's the one who translated Aristotle and these Greek medical texts and so on into Arabic for the Muslim scholars to study. So Islamic philosophy and medicine is dependent on Christian translations of Greek philosophy. And what that means, actually, is the supply lines for Aristotle getting to Western Europe are pretty long. It starts in Greek, it's translated into Syriac, from Syriac to Arabic, from Arabic to Latin. Okay. But it made it. And in Aristotle's Politics, what Aristotle says is that he defines man several different ways, but one of the things he says is that man is a political animal. Okay, we are an animal, but we are a political animal. We are an animal that lives with intentional, organized politics, based, in Aristotle's case, around the city-state, the polis, which is where we get the words politics from. Polis is the Greek word for a city-state. So Aristotle believed then that government, politics, is part of the natural world. It's part of the order of nature. It's part of human nature, in fact, to be political. It is an essential part of the definition of what it means to be human. And what that means is that, now Aristotle wasn't stupid enough to say that politics is always a good thing, but what he did say is that politics can be a good thing. It can be a positive thing. It can contribute to human flourishing if it's done right. When Aristotle made it into medieval Europe, he introduces a newer, more positive view of human government into Western Europe. Now, one particular set of details that I want to talk about from Aristotle is he argues that there are three basic political systems. And they fall into two categories. There are positive systems and there are negative systems, corrupted systems. The first of them, positive version, is a monarchy. A monarchy is ruled by a single individual. Its degenerate form, on the other side, is a tyranny. A tyranny occurs when the monarch rules out of self-interest rather than for the interest of the public, of the state. When the king is ruling for the interest of the state, for the good of his people, he's a king. When he's ruling out of self-interest, he's a tyrant. Now, monarchies have certain advantages. The biggest one is that in an emergency, the king can make fast decisions. And in an emergency situation, sometimes you really need fast decisions. So this is a really positive thing. The negative thing about a monarchy, though, is that if the king makes a mistake, there's nothing to buffer it. And it can have disastrous effects in society. Even if it's well-intentioned, it can still be disastrous. Now, your second form of government is an aristocracy. An aristocracy, in Aristotle's definition, is ruled by a small council that is specifically a deliberative council. That is to say, they deliberate, they discuss issues before they make decisions. The aristocracy has an advantage over the monarchy in that it's much less prone to mistakes. If you get a good group of people that are ruling the state, and they discuss issues among themselves, some of them may come up with a bad idea, but the others are going to recognize it's a bad idea, and as they discuss it, this will become obvious. They're far less likely to make errors. On the other hand, they can be rather slow when it comes to emergencies. If they spend all their time arguing about what to do, the state can fall before they ever act. Now, the degenerate version of an aristocracy is an oligarchy. An oligarchy occurs when this deliberative council starts ruling the state for its own benefit out of self-interest rather than for the good of the society. Okay, it's exactly the same thing as the difference between a king and a tyrant. Your third form of government in Aristotle is your republic. Now, a republic is, strictly speaking, it is ruled by representation. The representatives of the citizens rule the state. Republics have a huge advantage, which is buy-in. If people believe that, if people through their representatives have a say in the government, they're much more likely to be loyal to the government, much more likely to buy into the government's programs. Even if they disagree with them, they feel at least like their voice has been heard through their representative. They can be even slower than aristocracies, though. The counterpart to a republic is a democracy. A democracy is a degenerate republic, degenerate form of government, according to Aristotle. Now, by democracy, he meant something very specific. He was thinking of the city of Athens. In Athens, all decisions were made by a committee of the whole. All citizens met, and all citizens had a voice in what happened in the state. Now, the danger with that is that, first of all, not everybody is well informed. Secondly, people, Aristotle knew, people were ruled by their passions, and emotion could actually sway decisions. We talk about mob psychology. Emotions can sway the mob more than reason can, and Aristotle really believed you needed reason in politics. The real fear was that a demagogue would come along. A demagogue, well, the word democracy, we talk about it, we translate it usually as power to the people. And that's sort of correct, but the word demoi, which does mean the people, has the implication of the mob. Okay, so democracy in that sense is mob rule. And the danger is a demagogue could come along, a mob leader, who would sway the passions of the crowd and get them to do all kinds of irrational things because he's playing on their passions. And that's why democracy is a degenerate form of government. Aristotle had experience with this. He was an Athenian. And as he looked at Athenian history, he could see what happened when Athens was a pure democracy. There would be situations where generals, who were very capable people, would fight a battle and just lose, because it happens sometimes. And the Athenians were so mad at the general, they executed him. There are all kinds of things that happen that just are irrational in democracy. So that's a degenerate form of government. So each of these has its own strengths and weaknesses. So the ideal form of government is what was known as a mixed state, a state that combined different elements of all of these. Okay. So in the Middle Ages, you will have, in monarchies, you have a king, but the king always has a council with him. That's combining the monarchical form with the aristocratic form. The council is there to advise the king. And the king actually cannot act without the advice of his council. in anything serious. In medieval cities were republics, but they were almost always also real power. The real levers of power were controlled by a relatively small group of nobles or upper middle class people, upper level commoners, rich commoners, who met in a deliberative council. So that would combine republic and aristocracy. There were all kinds of attempts to blend these things because, again, the ideal following Aristotle is a mixed state, which is going to combine elements of different types. Keep that in mind. We're going to be seeing it again. I'm not giving you a quiz, but it is going to come back. Okay, so back to Aristotle. Medieval political theory, then, really develops as a dialectic, a dialogue between Aristotle with his positive view of government and Augustine with his negative view of government. That's really the key dynamic that is occurring here. Just like you've got a balance between church, state, and relations and a tug of war between the two. Who has authority over what? Who is superior in this relationship? Where does the church's authority end and the state's begin and vice versa? What happens about areas where they've got common interests? All of these kinds of things are driving politics on one level. The other thing that's driving it is this dialectic between Aristotle and Augustine. How much do we trust the state? How much emphasis do we give to state power? And how much do we have to guard against corruption within the state? In fact, one of the easiest ways of understanding how they combine is that Augustine explains why the column on the left turns into the column on the right. Okay. So Augustine explains why it is that monarchs degenerate to tyrants, aristocracies turn into oligarchies, republics can be infected by democracy. Okay, again, democracy in Aristotle's sense, not in our sense. Okay, so these are some of the key dynamics that really determine the way the Western political tradition develops. And it turns out that all of these are also very, very important for the U.S. Constitution. Aristotelian categories. There are three good forms of government in Aristotle. Review time. Monarchy, aristocracy, and republic. The founding fathers were extremely well-read in political theory. They knew all of the political arguments, the political debates, debates about, well, they were heavily influenced by Augustine via the Puritans. They were well aware of Aristotle. All of them knew these things. And they knew Aristotle's categories, and they knew the ideal of a mixed government. So, the monarchical principle is embodied by the president. The aristocratic principle is embodied by the Senate. And the republican principle by the House of Representatives, right? Okay. So, that's an Aristotelian mixed state. And the judiciary, in this case, is something sort of separate. It's there to play traffic cop, basically, or referee, I guess is a better way of saying it. Now, it's worth noting, I'll get to that later. Okay, so they're using Aristotelian categories in terms of how they frame the Constitution. And they're doing this self-consciously. They are well aware of the discussion. They are also well aware of the danger of, you know, they've got a positive sense that government can do good, but they've got a very pessimistic sense that government is likely to do bad, coming from the Aristotelian tradition. So they set up a system with multiple types of checks and balances to try to prevent it, or to try to hinder it, not prevent it, to try to hinder it from going toward corruption. More on that in a second. This is also the reason why, in the Constitution, it gives the federal government a certain set of enumerated powers. If you actually read the 10th Amendment, it says that the responsibilities of the federal government are few and specific. They are the ones that are specifically enumerated within the Constitution. The federal government does not, according to the Constitution, have a right to do anything that the Constitution does not explicitly give it the right to do. Anything that is a government responsibility that the Constitution does not give to the federal government is the responsibility of the states. That's the 10th Amendment. It is the single most ignored article in the entire Constitution. Okay. The idea of enumerated powers is there because it is a deliberate attempt to limit the power of the federal government because of fear of overreach, because fear that the federal government would act the way a tyrant does and begin working for self-aggrandizement, taking more power to itself, and in essence, embodying the city of man. You want to do your best to absolutely place strict limits and strict controls on the government, because otherwise it will turn into the city of man. Self-aggrandizement, grabbing all kinds of power anywhere it can, lording it over people, using people for its own self-interests and its own prestige. Okay. Rather than serving the people, it becomes the master. That's the point of the enumerated powers. Now, when it comes to religion, we get to the First Amendment. The First Amendment begins, "Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." That's the first clause of the First Amendment. Now, the First Amendment is part, of course, of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. These amendments, the Federalists who put together the Constitution resisted adding the Bill of Rights. And the reason they resisted it is not what you would think. The reason they resisted adding the Bill of Rights was because they were afraid that if you enumerated a set of rights, that what this would communicate is these are the only rights that people have. They would have preferred to have just left this open-ended. Okay. But there were a number of states who said, we do not want to risk that. We want specific limitations placed on the federal government so that the government cannot overreach. The Bill of Rights is designed to protect the individual from the government. That is explicitly and specifically what it is for. Because they know that the left-hand column turns to the right-hand column. And that left to it without all kinds of protections in place, there is a danger that the government is going to trample on the rights of the people. So they want to guarantee those rights, freedom from interference from the federal government. That's the whole point of the Bill of Rights. And it begins with freedom of religion. The reason why it begins there is, well, the First Amendment, I've got the list here. I don't have this one memorized. The First Amendment begins... Ooh, I don't have it in my notes. Excuse me. The First Amendment begins with freedom of conscience. Then it goes to freedom of speech, then freedom of the press, then freedom of assembly, then freedom to redress government, I believe, of redress. I believe that's the order here. The reason why this is the First Amendment and why it begins with freedom of religion is all of the other amendments flow from this one. And the order is important. The specific wording, let's break it down. Congress, starting there, it is about the federal government, not the state government. Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion. An establishment of religion is an 18th century phrase that means a state church. Congress cannot establish a national church for America. Individual states could. They could establish their own state churches. And in fact, many of the states that were in the original 13 had state churches. I live in Connecticut right now. The state church in Connecticut was the Congregational Church, and it stayed that way into the 1800s. So the First Amendment allowed individual states to have state churches, but the federal government could not have one. That's what an establishment of religion means, okay, in the 18th century. Or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The state cannot interfere with you practicing your religion. They cannot put any restrictions on how you practice your religion other than things like if you believe in child sacrifice, that's murder, you can't do that. Other than those sorts of general things, state can't interfere with your practice of your religion. Why is this important, and why is it first? What this is saying is that we have freedom of conscience. The state does not have authority over your conscience. And because the state has no authority over your conscience, everything else flows from there. It doesn't. You have the right to speak your mind. You have the right, actually, to criticize the government. You have the right to do this in your speech. You have the right to do this in the press. You have the right to meet in groups of any sort for any purpose at all. Even to meet in a group that is designed to protest government policy. That's really what they have in mind there. And freedom of the press, by the way, meant freedom to criticize the government. That's why they wanted freedom of the press, because they wanted the press to be there to be critical of the government, not to act as the Ministry of Propaganda, which is kind of what it is now. The point is, all of these things are there to protect us from the government because there's the fear of government overreach. And it starts with your freedom to practice your faith without government interference. Now, I've talked about, you know, we all know about checks and balances. I talked about the issue of the three different types of government and how that works out. The founders put these things in place as a hindrance to government corruption. They assumed, in the Constitution as originally written, there's no provision for political parties. Okay. The fact is that really from the Middle Ages, the idea of a political party, they called them factions. The idea of a faction or a political party was seen as the death of the republic. If factions developed, the republic would die. And the Constitution was written without political parties in mind. So the original provisions of the Constitution said whoever got the most electoral votes was president, whoever got the second most was vice president. So we would have President Obama and Vice President Romney right now. They realized pretty quickly, particularly with the conflict that came up between Jefferson and Adams, that this wasn't going to work. And so they set up the idea of voting for slates rather than individuals, which opened the door to party. The reason why that was feared is because they hoped that with the setup, with the different branches of government, the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they hoped that the members of each institution would have primary loyalty to their institution. And thus, they would keep an eye on the others to prevent overstep. So the House and Senate would prevent presidential overstep. The House and President would prevent senatorial overstep. And the Senate and the President would prevent the House from overstepping. This was the intention. And the fear was that if political parties came along, loyalty would be to party, to faction, more than to institution, and you would get coalitions that brought together the president, the Senate, and the House in a vertical coalition rather than the sort of horizontal things that they had originally been thinking of. And that vertical coalition could then introduce tyranny. They worried about that a lot, and they tried to do their best to prevent it by setting up the structure the way they did. Now, having said that, they did not believe that the structure of the government could prevent corruption because they knew how corruptible people are. And they knew that people would always find a way around the rules or they would secretly break the rules or they would ignore the rules or something like that out of self-interest. So they, although they've got checks and balances, although they've got this sort of competition implicit between the different branches of government, they never really thought that that by itself would prevent the government from being corrupt. The only way you can prevent government from being corrupt, according to the founders, is to elect people of virtue to office. If you do not elect good people, the government will become corrupt, inevitably and inescapably. Everything depends on the quality of the candidates, the quality of the personnel. They are very, very clear about this. So the only defense is to know the people in your community and vote for the ones who are worthy of office, who can be trusted with it. Generally, people who aren't too thrilled about having it. Without that, they said that a corrupt government is inevitable. Kind of a depressing thought, isn't it? But with that, I'm done. So we're going to stop here. We'll take a little bit of a break. Now, before we do, sit down, Dick. Before we do, I am going to do a shameless plug. I would like to explain some of the books back there. If you are more interested in, if you're interested in hearing more about the topics that I'm talking about, a lot of them are included in this. Why You Think the Way You Do. It's a history of Western civilization through the lens of changing worldviews. It talks a lot about the way Christianity has shaped Western culture and a lot about what is happening with the decline of the influence of Christianity in the culture, with a guess of the direction things may be heading from here. A second book that I, again, that is a major theme that I will be talking about in several of the other talks is this one. It's a nice short one, you'll notice, on the image of God. It's 14 very brief chapters, about 1,500 words or so each, with study questions after them, exploring a variety of different aspects of the image of God. I think this is the single most important doctrine in the Bible when it comes to understanding humanity. And you will be surprised at the implications of it if you actually read this, because it's got it extends into a whole bunch of areas you would never even consider if you didn't really spend a lot of time studying it. And oddly enough, there's almost nothing written on the subject. Even theologians, for some reason, don't touch it often. So it's, like I said, it's a rather brief one, but I think it'll be a good introduction for you. Third book, Portals. Portals, I wrote this at the request of Chuck Colson. Chuck has a way, or had a way, of analyzing worldviews using four questions, and he used to set it up as a grid. And he asked me to just write something brief, expanding out each of the boxes in his grid, the answers to the questions from different worldviews. He originally started with four worldviews. I upped it to seven. And it's basically set around those. I'm covering this, these will give you a good introduction to the way your neighbors think today in a variety of different areas, because there are multiple worldviews at work in America today, and this is specifically focused on American worldviews. And lastly, I am a Reformation historian. I've got a book called The Reformation for Armchair Theologians. It is a history of the Reformation. It's got a lot of my snide New Jersey humor in it and cartoons. And with that, I will leave it at that. So.